Could I convincingly feign insanity, pass doctors' examinations, and spend a week among the insane without being discovered? This was the audacious challenge posed to me by the World newspaper on September 22nd. Despite my editor's concern about my chronic smile, I accepted this delicate mission to chronicle asylum life truthfully. Using the pseudonym Nellie Brown, I embarked on what would become one of journalism's most daring undercover investigations. The resulting exposé shocked America, catalyzing immediate reforms in mental health care and establishing Bly as a pioneering figure in investigative journalism. Her work inspired generations of reporters and was recently adapted into a critically acclaimed film starring Christina Ricci. Even today, medical ethics courses study her methods and findings, while her courage in revealing institutional abuses continues to resonate with modern whistleblowers and advocates for vulnerable populations. How does one convincingly appear insane when perfectly sane? Standing before my mirror at night, I practice the staring eyes I'd heard characterize the mentally ill, opening mine as wide as possible and staring unblinkingly at my reflection, an unsettling sight even to myself. Between practice sessions, I read fragments of ghost stories until dawn, steeling myself for the ordeal ahead. I bid farewell to my toothbrush and other modern conveniences, donned old clothing selected for the occasion, and ventured out on my crazy business. Rather than immediately feigning insanity, I strategically chose the temporary home for females on 2nd Avenue as my starting point. My reasoning was sound. Women would quickly have me removed if they believed me insane, setting my journey to Blackwell's Island in motion. With limited funds in my pocket, knowing the sooner I ran out of money, the sooner I'd be put out, I began my performance as Nellie Brown, the insane girl, walking down the avenue with a faraway expression. The transformation required constant vigilance. Every gesture, every word needed careful calculation. I couldn't simply act wild or incoherent. That would be too obvious. Instead, I cultivated a specific persona, a woman confused about her identity, fearful of her surroundings, and fixated on imaginary dangers. The performance needed to be subtle enough to seem authentic to medical professionals, yet clear enough to trigger concern from those around me. What surprised me most was how quickly people accepted the facade. We expect insanity to announce itself dramatically, but in reality, just a few peculiar behaviors and statements were enough to make others uncomfortable and suspicious. This revelation was both empowering for my mission and disturbing in its implications. How easily might someone genuinely confused or distressed be labeled insane based on superficial observations? As I prepared to enter a world few outsiders had seen, I wondered, would the reality match the rumors of abuse, or would I find the stories exaggerated, as part of me hoped? Either way, I was determined to bring the truth to light, whatever personal discomfort it might cause me. My performance began in earnest at the temporary home, where I was greeted by a short, yellow-haired 13-year-old who directed me brusquely to the back parlor. The cheerless room contained just basic furniture with barely any daylight, the entire setting a mockery of the word home, with its bare floors and unvarnished tables. After paying my 30 cents for shared accommodation, I waited for the perfect moment to display my insane points. When Mrs. Stannard, the assistant matron, asked what troubled me, seeing sadness in my face, I responded vaguely that everything is so sad. Then I delivered my first effective blow, whispering fearfully that the other women look horrible to me, just like crazy women, and expressing terror about murderers going uncaught. Her sudden, convulsive start told me my performance was working. Throughout the evening, I maintained my charade, insisting the women looked crazy despite her assurances they were honest working women. The atmosphere grew increasingly tense as I repeatedly mentioned everyone looking crazy, though the residents were slow to react. At bedtime, I expressed fear of the other crazy women, causing alarm among the residents, who began calling me a poor loon and suggesting police intervention. What struck me most powerfully was how quickly compassion transformed into fear and rejection. These women, many of whom had faced hardships themselves, initially showed concern for my apparent distress. Yet the moment my behavior suggested mental instability, their sympathy vanished, replaced by discomfort and a desire for distance. "Get her away from me," one woman demanded, while another declared, "She's crazy enough to kill us all." This immediate social isolation, this invisible wall that rose between me and others, offered my first glimpse into the world of the mentally ill. Before even reaching any institution, I was experiencing the stigma and separation that accompanies a label of insanity. People spoke about me rather than to me, made decisions without consulting me, and treated my words as meaningless ravings rather than attempts at communication. The evening was wretchedly lonely under the dim gaslight, the atmosphere so depressing I felt it wouldn't take much to make me truly fit for the asylum. This thought haunted me. How many actual patients began their journey to institutionalization not because of genuine mental illness, but because of temporary distress magnified by isolation and misunderstanding? When Mrs. Stannard returned with two policemen, my refusal to leave without my lost trunks resulted in threats to drag me through the streets if I didn't come quietly. At the station house, I maintained my persona as Nellie Brown, but claimed not to know where I came from. Mrs. Stannard explained my strange behavior, describing me as a poor unfortunate driven crazy by inhuman treatment. At Essex Market Police Courtroom, Judge Duffy called me forward, asking me to lift my veil, saying even the Queen of England would have to do so. When questioned about my identity, I maintained I was looking for my trunks. The judge was sympathetic, noting I was well-dressed and a lady with perfect English, declaring I must be somebody's darling. He wished reporters were present to help identify me, which frightened me as I feared being recognized. What became immediately apparent was how the justice system processed cases of apparent mental illness, with a mixture of paternalism, superficial assessment, and hasty conclusions. Judge Duffy spent perhaps 5 minutes evaluating my condition before determining I had been drugged and brought to the city. No medical tests were performed, no detailed history was taken. My well-dressed appearance and proper speech seemed to earn me more consideration than might be afforded to a shabbier, less articulate person, revealing the class biases embedded in the system. When a reporter arrived, I refused to see him, then ran back and forth through the office to reinforce my apparent insanity. This performance, lasting mere minutes, was enough to convince everyone present that I required institutional care. The ease with which I manipulated these perceptions was troubling. If I, with no medical symptoms whatsoever, could so easily be classified as insane, how many genuinely confused, distressed, or simply eccentric individuals might be wrongfully committed? The ambulance surgeon's examination was equally cursory. He checked my tongue, pulse, and eyes, then pronounced I had been taking drugs, specifically belladonna. My naturally enlarged pupils, due to nearsightedness, were misinterpreted as a symptom, demonstrating how normal variations could be pathologized when viewed through a predetermined lens of illness. The doctor wrote his observations and announced he would take me home, a euphemism for Bellevue Hospital's insane ward, all based on this brief, superficial assessment. As I was escorted through curious onlookers to the waiting ambulance, I reflected on the extraordinary power these professionals wielded. With a few words on paper, they could strip a person of freedom, dignity, and credibility, all while believing they were acting in that person's best interest. At Bellevue, the dehumanization process began immediately. Nurse Scott threatened that I was in an asylum for the insane and would be there a long time if I didn't obey her commands to remove my hat. When she threatened force, I defiantly answered I'd remove her cap if she took my hat. a moment of genuine anger that I quickly suppressed, fearing that showing too much temper might reveal my sanity. The physical environment reflected the institution's priorities: control over comfort, efficiency over dignity. The hall was unbearably cold with open windows. When I complained, the nurses curtly reminded me that, as I was in a charity place, I could not expect much else. This callous response revealed a fundamental attitude that those receiving charity care should be grateful for whatever treatment they received, however inadequate or uncomfortable. Meals were served on tin plates at a bare table, cold meat and potatoes barely edible. When I refused to join the others, Mary, a patient worker, brought me food separately and whispered, "Have ye any pennies about ye, dearie? They'll take 'em all from ye anyway." This small act of kindness, one patient helping another, stood in stark contrast to the staff's indifference. Though hungry, I could barely eat the unappetizing food, so Mary kindly provided milk and crackers instead. The examination by the doctor was perfunctory and predetermined. When I claimed to be from Cuba and gave nonsensical answers, he pronounced me positively demented and a hopeless case without any thorough investigation. This gave me a smaller regard for doctors' abilities and greater confidence in my deception. The ease with which medical professionals accepted my performance suggested they were seeing what they expected to see rather than what was actually before them. Throughout the night, nurses loudly read to each other, walked heavily down halls checking patients hourly, and prepared breakfast noisily. A young doctor visited me late at night, sitting on my bed with his arm around my shoulders, asking questions about Cuba, an inappropriate intimacy that suggested how vulnerable female patients might be to exploitation. Between ambulance sirens and occasional yells from the mail department, I passed my first sleepless night at Bellevue, already witnessing how the institution's practices seemed designed to exacerbate rather than alleviate mental distress. What struck me most powerfully was the contradiction between the hospital's supposed healing mission and its actual practices. Every aspect of the environment, from the cold rooms to the inedible food, from the lack of privacy to the constant noise, seemed calculated to increase patients' discomfort and distress rather than promote recovery. If this was the standard of care at one of New York's primary facilities, what might await me at Blackwell's Island? Sunday morning began harshly at 6 a.m. when nurses stripped my bedding and returned my clothing. After a series of perfunctory examinations where doctors asked identical questions about seeing faces on walls and hearing voices, we received the news we'd be transferred to Blackwell's Island at 1:30. As departure time approached, I grew increasingly nervous about being discovered. The journey itself was degrading. A rough attendant half dragged me to an ambulance where my fellow patients, Miss Neville, Miss Mayard, Mrs. Fox, and Mrs. Shantz, joined me. At the wharf, police held back curious crowds as we boarded a boat bound for the insane asylum. In a filthy cabin with closed windows, we sat on narrow benches alongside an old woman with a basket of bread scraps while two coarse female attendants guarded the door, spitting tobacco juice on the floor. Arriving at Blackwell's Island, I was forcibly escorted off the boat by attendants who gripped my flesh painfully. When I asked where we were, the man replied ominously, "Blackwell's Island, an insane place where you'll never get out of." These words, intended to crush hope, revealed the fundamental philosophy behind the institution. Patients were not expected to recover and return to society, but to remain indefinitely separated from it. The physical journey mirrored the psychological one that many patients experienced, a one-way passage from the world of the sane to that of the insane, with each transition stripping away more dignity and autonomy. We were no longer individuals with unique histories and needs, but interchangeable units to be processed through a system designed for containment rather than healing. As we approached through beautiful lawns, my satisfaction at achieving my investigative goal was dampened by the distress on my companions' faces. these poor women faced imprisonment for life through no fault of their own. We passed a building emitting such a horrible stench that I had to hold my breath, later confirming it was the kitchen, ironically marked with a sign reading, "Visitors are not allowed on this road." This detail spoke volumes. Areas that might reveal the institution's true conditions were carefully kept from public view. Inside, we climbed narrow stone steps and entered a vestibule where the door locked behind us. Despite knowing I was sane and would be released soon, my heart gave a sharp twinge at being declared insane by four doctors and locked behind asylum bars. The psychological impact of this moment, of hearing that heavy door lock, cannot be overstated. Even with my secret knowledge of my impending release, I felt a wave of despair. For those without such knowledge, that sound represented the end of life as they had known it. The examination process at Blackwell's Island revealed the superficiality of psychiatric evaluation in the institution. Dr. Kinnear's assessment of me was conducted with shocking unprofessionalism. The nurse incorrectly identified my eye color as gray, they were brown or hazel, and they bantered about her upcoming day off. When measuring my height, the nurse couldn't read the measurement, prompting the doctor to leave his desk to show her 5 feet 5 inches. The same carelessness continued with weighing me, the nurse calling him by his first name and he warning her she was getting too fresh, both laughing throughout. When I protested, "I am not sick and I do not want to stay here. No one has a right to shut me up in this manner," he ignored me completely, writing my fate in his book without response. This dismissal of patient testimony was perhaps the most telling aspect of the examination. My own account of my condition was considered irrelevant to the diagnostic process. Even more disturbing was the treatment of those genuinely in need of medical attention. Miss Tilly Mayard, suffering from nervous debility after fever, rationally explained her condition and begged for proper testing, but was dismissed without sympathy. Mrs. Shans, who spoke no English, was cruelly denied an interpreter despite Miss Group's ability to speak German. The doctor merely laughed when Miss Group initially denied her German speaking ability, leaving Mrs. Shans confined without understanding why or where she was, a fate worse than a criminal's, who at least receives a fair trial. The pattern was consistent: hasty judgments based on minimal evidence, dismissal of patients' own accounts, and a complete absence of therapeutic intent. These weren't medical examinations in any meaningful sense, but rather bureaucratic procedures designed to process new arrivals into the system with minimal effort. What became clear was that once labeled insane, a person's every word and action was interpreted through that lens. Rational protests were seen as denial or delusion. Emotional responses to mistreatment were viewed as symptoms rather than legitimate reactions. The circular logic was perfect in its cruelty. If you claim you're sane, that's exactly what an insane person would say. This approach to diagnosis didn't just fail to identify genuine mental illness, it actively manufactured the appearance of illness by placing people in conditions that would provoke extreme responses in even the most stable individuals. As I would soon discover, the asylum environment itself was perfectly designed to exacerbate or even create the very conditions it supposedly treated. Life within Blackwell's Island was structured to maximize patient suffering while minimizing staff effort. Our days began at 5:30 a.m. when we were rudely awakened. 45 patients shared 2 filthy towels in the bathroom, and our hair was painfully combed with just 6 combs among us. We spent our days sitting motionless on hard benches from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m. We couldn't talk, move around, or have any reading material. This enforced idleness was perhaps the cruelest aspect of the regime, leaving patients with nothing but their own troubled thoughts for company. The food was deliberately inedible. Breakfast consisted of cold tea, buttered bread, mine contained a spider, and oatmeal with molasses that tasted like paste. Dinner brought soup in the same bowls used for tea, 1 cold potato, and spoiled beef chunks. With no knives or forks, patients struggled to eat the tough meat with their fingers. Those with poor teeth couldn't manage it at all. After the first 2 days, there was no salt for anything. Patients were forced to choke down unseasoned boiled fish, mutton, beef, and potatoes while glimpsing the nurses' and doctors' meals of fruits, white bread, and proper meats. The contrast between patient and staff accommodations revealed the institution's priorities. While we shivered in cold rooms, slept on impossible beds made high in the center and sloping on both sides, and wore inadequate clothing, staff enjoyed comfortable quarters and proper meals. When I requested a nightgown, Miss Group coldly informed me, "We have not such things in this institution. This is charity, and you should be thankful for what you get." Most disturbing was the sight of patients forced to labor without compensation. Some worked in the scrub brush factory, mat factory, or laundry receiving no pay, only hunger for their efforts. Others were made to perform cleaning duties throughout the asylum. During our brief outdoor walks, I was horrified to see 52 women fastened to a long rope with leather belts pulling an iron cart containing two more patients, a scene reminiscent of slavery rather than medical care. The beautiful lawns offered no comfort, as patients weren't allowed on the grass and couldn't even keep fallen leaves they picked up. Above a pavilion of helpless lunatics hung the cruelly ironic motto, "While I live, I hope." Yet hope was precisely what the institution systematically destroyed through its practices. I challenge any physician to subject a healthy woman to these conditions and see how quickly she becomes insane. The combination of sensory deprivation, social isolation, physical discomfort, and nutritional inadequacy would inevitably produce symptoms of mental distress in even the most stable individual. The asylum wasn't treating mental illness, it was manufacturing it. The nurse's brutality toward patients was perhaps the most shocking aspect of asylum life. I witnessed Miss Grady and other attendants torment Arita Littlepage about her age until she became hysterical, then slap her face, knock her head, and choke her before dragging her to a closet where her screams were silenced. They did the same to an elderly woman named Mrs. Grady or O'Keefe, who had been harmlessly talking to herself. Miss Grady later boasted she had settled the old fool for a while. When Miss Tilly Mayard had a fit, Miss Neville caught her while the nurses cruelly suggested letting her fall to teach her a lesson. I reported this to Superintendent Dent, whose response was to roughly pinch Miss Mayard between the eyebrows until her face turned crimson and she regained consciousness. She suffered terrible headaches afterward, and her condition worsened daily. The nurses seemed to take particular pleasure in tormenting the most vulnerable patients. They mocked Sarah Fishbaum, a Hebrew woman who spoke little English, by asking if she'd like a nice young man or suggesting she make advances toward the doctors, cruelly exploiting her supposed delusion rather than treating it. They tormented Matilda, a small German woman who railed against lawyers who had taken her property, with Miss Grady spitting in Matilda's ear under the pretense of whispering to her. Josephine Despreau, a French woman who appeared completely sane, recounted how she had been taken to the station house after becoming ill while preparing breakfast. Unfamiliar with American procedures and unable to make herself understood, she was committed to the asylum. When she initially cried about her hopeless situation, Miss Grady and assistants choked her severely enough to leave her throat permanently sore. Louise, the pretty German girl with fever, complained of beatings from Miss Grady and her inability to eat the horrible food. She recounted how Dr. Field at Bellevue had cruelly pinched her ribs with his crutch when she refused to continue an examination. When I left, she was bedridden with fever, praying for death. What made these abuses particularly horrifying was their systematic nature. This wasn't occasional misconduct by rogue staff members, but standard practice, openly discussed, and even celebrated among attendants. Violence was not an aberration, but a primary method of control, a fact known to administrators who either condoned or ignored these practices. the bath ritual exemplified this institutionalized cruelty. Despite my protests, I was forcibly undressed and placed in an ice-cold bathtub where a deranged woman scrubbed me with soft soap, covering my face and hair despite my begging. 3 buckets of freezing water were dumped over my head, leaving me gasping and shivering. Miss Mayard received the same treatment despite her illness and sore head. This wasn't hygiene, but humiliation disguised as care. The asylum was a human rat trap, easy to enter but impossible to leave. During my stay, I repeatedly told doctors I was sane and requested release, but my insistence only deepened their doubts. When I asked what doctors were there for, one replied, "to take care of patients and test their sanity." I pointed out that of 16 doctors on the island, only 2 paid any attention to patients. I begged them to examine me properly, but they dismissed me, claiming other sane women were suffering from delusions. The longing for home never dies within the asylum walls. One girl told me daily, "I dreamed of my mother last night. I think she may come today and take me home," though she'd been confined 4 years. I've watched women gaze longingly toward the city lights visible between the bars, so near yet impossibly far, like heaven from hell. Letters were precious rarities. I saw only 1 delivered during my stay. Visitors created excitement but little comfort, often recoiling upon learning someone was a patient. The weekly merry-go-round ride was the only outside amusement offered. After months of confinement, thoughts of the outside world fade, leaving patients to contemplate their hopeless fate. The physical architecture reinforced this imprisonment. During the night, nurses with keys checked each room repeatedly, making sleep impossible. I worried about fire hazards. With every door locked separately and windows barred, escape would be impossible for the 300 women. We were literally trapped within walls designed not for treatment, but for containment. What became clear was that the asylum system operated on a fundamental presumption of permanence. Patients weren't expected to recover and return to society. They were expected to remain institutionalized indefinitely. This presumption shaped every aspect of care, from the cursory initial examinations to the absence of any meaningful therapeutic interventions. Why invest in rehabilitation for those you've already written off? Most disturbing was how the system perpetuated itself through circular logic. Any protest against confinement was interpreted as further evidence of mental instability. Any improvement in condition was dismissed as temporary or deceptive. Any rational argument for release was seen as manipulative. The system was perfectly designed to validate its own judgments, regardless of reality. When lawyer Peter Hendricks finally arranged my release, I felt a strange pain abandoning my companions to their fate. These women, many of whom showed no signs of mental illness beyond the distress caused by their confinement, would remain trapped in a system designed to keep them there. Freedom was ultimately sweeter than ever after 10 days in the madhouse, but the knowledge of those left behind tempered that sweetness with profound sadness. Soon after my release, I was summoned before the grand jury, which I welcomed as an opportunity to help those I'd left behind. I swore to my story's truth and related everything from the temporary home until my release. The jurors requested I accompany them on a visit to the island. Despite attempts to keep the visit secret, commissioners and Dr. McDonald were notified an hour before our arrival. The institution was clearly on exhibition. The kitchen was spotless with conspicuous barrels of salt, beautiful white bread unlike what we were served, improved beds and new washing basins replacing our old buckets. Most tellingly, every patient I had mentioned in my exposé had been moved, discharged, or transferred elsewhere. When questioned, staff denied knowledge of some patients or claimed others had been released to relatives. If my judgments about these patients' sanity were wrong, why had they been hidden away? Tilly Mayard had deteriorated shockingly in just 2 weeks. Despite these obvious cover-up attempts, the grand jury sustained my claims. Their report recommended all the changes I had proposed. My greatest consolation was that the Committee of Appropriation provided $1 million more than ever before for the benefit of the insane. This outcome validated the power of investigative journalism to drive meaningful social change. By experiencing the asylum system firsthand and documenting its abuses with specific, verifiable details, I had accomplished what years of complaints and rumors had failed to do: force public acknowledgement of institutional failures and secure resources for reform. The experience transformed my understanding of mental health care and institutional power. I had entered the investigation wondering if stories of asylum abuses were exaggerated. I emerged knowing they were, if anything, understated. The system I encountered wasn't failing at its therapeutic mission. It had abandoned that mission entirely in favor of warehousing society's unwanted members under the thinnest veneer of medical care. Most importantly, I learned that the line between sane and insane was far more arbitrary than most people realized. Many women I met in the asylum showed no more signs of mental illness than the average person on the street. They had simply found themselves caught in a system designed to interpret every behavior through the lens of pathology. Their stories revealed how easily social nonconformity, language barriers, temporary distress, or simple misfortune could lead to permanent institutionalization. My 10 days in the madhouse taught me that true insanity often lies not in the minds of patients, but in the systems we create to contain them. Systems that prioritize control over care, efficiency over dignity, and institutional convenience over human needs. By exposing these realities, I hope to spark not just reform, but a fundamental rethinking of how society approaches mental illness and those who suffer from it.